Welcome to our final session on Three Reformers with Dr. John Wilson. Today's topic is John Calvin, the Reformation of the Refugees and Church Discipline. Next Sunday, we begin a very special new five-week series with Professor John Burgess from Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. The topic is Christians, the Nations, and War. And as you might guess, it will focus on what's happening in Ukraine. And next Sunday, that will be the subject of the introductory session. This promises to be an excellent and timely series, so I hope you can return and invite others to come. And now I'll turn it over to John Wilson to open us with prayer.
Okay, let us begin with a prayer. Lord, we thank you for this season and for its meaning. We thank you for the day, for spring, for its encouragement, for life. We pray for the victims of war and for the perpetrators. Give us peace and meaning in this time. In Christ's name, amen. We close now with the series with Calvin. And again, I emphasize that I'm not covering even the most important part aspects of Calvin, as I did not with Luther or with Zwingli. I'm picking out some things that are pretty characteristic of these theologians and kind of showing you the relevance they have in the thought and then trying to compare them. You see, we're starting out with dates and we're working into the persecutions of the Reformation period and after the Reformation, which are very, very severe. First with Luther, 2 years after Luther's death, there is a war, which the Protestants lose. The emperor who wins declares the Augsburg interim. It's an interim until the problems involving the two confessions, Catholic and Protestant, can be ironed out by a council, the church council. And it's interesting that the emperor wants the Protestants involved in the conversation, which, as it turns out, they never are because the Catholics don't allow them in. But it takes some time before we get to a council. Charles keeps requiring a council, and the Pope keeps delaying it, so it doesn't happen. So what happens in the Augsburg interim? Reversal of the Reformation, re-Catholicizing. It's the first movement of refugees, especially those who are theologians of some statue in southern Germany, in Strasbourg. Martin Bucer goes to England in this time. Well, 4 years later, there's another war, and the Protestants win. And this is, and we'll go into the details of it because it's quite interesting how it happens. But the Protestants win, and we get the Augsburg Peace. Now, what happens in the Augsburg Peace is the very famous rule how to settle the religious question. And it's very, very famous, and you probably know it from your history. If I say it, I call it to your mind, that the prince of the territory determines the religion of the territory. So if you have a Protestant prince, the religion is Protestant. If you have a Catholic prince, the territory is Catholic. So this meant movement of refugees, because if you didn't want to re-Catholicize, you had to move. So let's say you were a Protestant minority in a Catholic area, you either had to reconvert or you had to move. Now this stays in effect for a very long time. And like I say, it's quite historical. Where it hit the Protestants especially bad was, for example, in Austria, where we have a very strongly growing Protestant population, and they have to leave. Either you re-Catholicize or you leave. So it's the first movement involving Lutheran Germans. Then we come to, of course, the 30 Years' War comes up later, and that's very famous, and I'm sure you remember that from your history, 1618, 1648. This war is usually presented to us as a religious war, but it's very much a war dynasty of princes and kings fighting each other for power. Certainly it's also religious, but it would certainly be wrong to say this was just a religious war. It's mainly a war for dynasty power. And the powers, you said previous to Reformation, the powers are really in conflict with each other. They're constant wars. It's just incredible. And the French allying with the Turks against the emperor, who's coming from Spain. Why do the French ally with the Turks? To defeat the emperor. So in internal politics, power struggles inside Europe determine the resistance against the Turkish invasions, who as good as take over Hungary. And in 1525, we're at the gates of Vienna, almost take Vienna. So it's a remarkable story that you cannot read without looking at the politics, the power struggles. Right in France, affair of the placards. This was when little notes were placed in the house of the king, which were pro-Protestant and anti-Catholic. And they enraged the king, and he caused a major persecution. But the persecution had begun before. Calvin has already fled France because he's associated with Reformation, very high-ranking people in the university who have are making open statements about supporting Luther in the 1520s. This is quite early and into the 30s. Calvin is associated as a very young humanist. He's a humanist scholar. You remember all that that means. Who's also reading Luther. Very interesting the way he describes his conversion. It was apparently through reading Luther that he experienced conversion. But he is, by the time we get to the affair of the placards, which is a major persecution, Calvin has already been a refugee. He goes, finally he finds refuge in Switzerland, where he writes, as a very young man, his first edition of the Institutes, which makes him famous. And for this reason, he is stopped on a route when he was traveling. He stopped in Geneva, and he's demanded to stay and become a reformer in the city. So, and it's interesting that Calvin is kind of grabbed, made a pastor, without ever having gone through the ordination process. He's never ordained. He's just taken in and made a pastor. Now, his whole life is very much focused on the problem of the refugees. Just about everything he does has to do with the refugees. The affair of the placards. We get massive persecution and flight refugees. Now, Protestantism has spread very, very rapidly into France, especially southern France. Large areas of southern France are almost entirely Protestant. At the same time, we have entrenched Catholic interests, very high nobles, especially the Guise family, G-U-I-S-E. And it's very interesting that this family is actually the root family of Mary, Queen of Scots. A Guise, Mary, who is a Guise, will marry James, King of Scotland, and her child is Mary, Queen of Scots. And this is associated with the most Catholic family and the most interested family among the nobility, the most interested in persecuting Protestants and in making sure Catholicism wins. But the spread of Protestantism, it goes into the royalty. Refugees, the first place they're coming is into Geneva, because Calvin has already made himself known as a French theologian writing for French, and they are coming into Geneva. Now, Geneva is itself an interesting case. Geneva is protected. It is a small city that has, in the course of those city reformations that we talked about last time, has won its independence. But it sits right next to Savoy. Savoy is on the border, the Duchy of Savoy. Savoy is a Catholic power and very powerful part of France. And Savoy is a constant threat. Why doesn't Savoy act? Because in the backside of Geneva is Bern. And Bern by this time is Zwinglian, devoutly Zwinglian in every way. And they are the back support, the military support for Geneva. And Bern is just too powerful for Savoy to take a chance. They will later, sometime after Calvin's death, they will try in something that's come to be known as the Escalade, where ladders were put up. And I just happened to notice recently, so you see this in Geneva stamps and so forth. If you're in Switzerland, they always have the Escalade. It's the time they repelled Savoy. And it's interesting that Cadillac has picked this up. I recently saw an edition of the Cadillacs, and it's called Escalade. And I know where that comes from. Sounds very European, which it certainly is. I wonder what ladders have to do with Cadillacs. Anyway, all right, the first great persecution, the Fair of the Placards. Nobility, nobility are converted to Calvinism. Of course, at this time, it's just Protestantism, but it's Calvin. Calvin is the one spearheading it. Very many well-trained middle-class artisans. And this is something going to be very characteristic of the refugees. Wherever they go, they are bringing skills with them, and France is losing the skills. Now, the persecutions go for a long time. You can see all of that that's listed, continuing waves of persecution, and yet in between, Protestantism continues to grow, spread, increase, become more solidified in France, until we get to the great persecution, St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, 1572. Now, this is after Calvin has died. What happens is a Protestant prince is to marry the king's daughter, and it's a big celebration in Paris, and all of the Protestant all of their higher level people are in, all the nobility are in for the wedding. And whoever it is, no one really knows who gave the order, but the order to kill them. And in the frame of the court were all of these high ranking Protestants who gathered, nobles. Right? They're all murdered. And this sets a murder, a persecution in France, in Paris. In the city of Paris, everybody generally says 5,000 people were killed. Then it also spreads. It's kind of a signal to kill Protestants everywhere in France. And the numbers vary depending on who you're reading, whether you're reading a Catholic or a Protestant, but it's many thousands. Protestant estimate is 60,000 Catholic estimates come to something like 20. But this is huge, an enormous persecution. And it sets again people in flight. And where are they going? Well, we've had waves of persecution. Just St. Bartholomew's Day massacre is just the worst. But there are waves of persecution. So we've got waves of refugees. Geneva, during Calvin's time, fills up with refugees. The population of the city before Calvin is something like 16,000. At the height of the refugee period, it's around 30,000 French who are coming in. And Calvin himself is very much focused on the French, because that's his country, that's where he's interested in the Reformation. And one of the complaints is, by the Genevans, he's giving too much attention to the French. But it's absolutely full of French. But they're also going elsewhere. This is the great Huguenot group, right? That's the way the French Protestants were known. They're often asked, where does that name come from? Probably comes from the German word, or the Swiss word, Eidgenoss. That's the way the German Swiss talk about the covenant that holds the Swiss together. It's an oath. Eid is oath. And Genoss, that means the comrades, the group. So the Eidgenossen are the Swiss who have joined together by oath. So probably Huguenot comes from Eidgenoss. That's probably the origin. And of course, we probably know people with Huguenot backgrounds that have come into America through England or perhaps through Holland. Holland becomes also a major place to go in refuge, although soon Holland itself, Netherlands, were embroiled in persecutions. All right, the Edict of Nantes, or Nantes, 1598, that's to be mentioned because this was when the king declared a peace, a truce, no persecution. And in this period, Protestantism again flourishes, especially middle class, artisans, skilled labor, same time in the nobility. Whenever restrictions are relaxed, the spread occurs quite rapidly. And then you get to the next edict, Fontainebleau, 1685, persecution again. Again, it's outlawed, and again, we have murders, killings, and again, the flight. So you could say the whole history of France for a century is a history of persecution, pauses, and flight. And Calvin's constant focus is on the refugee problem. We don't see that so much in the institutes. Now, institutes, what does that word mean? Institutes of Christian religion, that's his major work, two big volumes. Institutes means essentially principles or foundations. So principles of the Christian faith. You don't see so much of the refugee problem there. He's focused on systematic theology, but his sermons, certainly his practical work is clearly focused into France. Then you see the persecutions aren't finally ended until we get to the French Revolution. And that's amazing. The French Revolution and Protestants constantly under persecution or threat of persecution up until that time. And where are the Protestants at the time of the French Revolution? A very small minority, practically no significance. They have been as good as eliminated. And they're mainly in Eastern France, Strasbourg there in that area. I remember from my time there that they used to say Peugeot, the car maker, was Protestant. So Protestants drove Peugeot. I didn't really see that much. I just heard the story. Okay. Netherlands. Persecutions from 1521. And if you've read history of the Netherlands, you know it was very severe under Spanish rule and very harsh persecution also there. The difference is that the Dutch finally win. The Protestants in France essentially lose. The Protestants in the Netherlands win, thanks to Prince of Orange. And that whole concept of Orange goes into Protestant history, especially Northern Ireland. The Orange opposed to the green of the Catholic Irish, celebrating a victory of William of Orange over the attempts of essentially the Guise family Catholics to return the Jacobins to power. The James II and his progeny to return. In any case, the Dutch suffer a great deal, but finally win. And then England, you've got the comparative stories, dates, and certainly, I guess most of you know that from English history, Bloody Mary. And during that reign, very many refugees leave England, certainly leadership. And that's, she goes for leadership. Close to 300 clergy are burned, deliberately burned to make a spectacle in her attempt to reverse the course of Reformation in England. And Elizabeth comes, and under Elizabeth especially, then we get England as a place of refuge. So very many refugees going into England. Any questions or comments just on the dates? So you might say it's remarkable Protestantism survived at all, but it certainly did. All right, Calvin on providence and predestination, number two, an election. Let me just stop and make a comment about this doctrine of predestination and providence. Nothing in the modern period has fallen more out of favor than these doctrines. The elect, Calvin certainly said, on the other side, they're the reprobates. Those who are not elected are doomed. I remember a long discussion about this with a professor who was saying, well, what do you think happened to Hitler? Where do you think he wound up? Vicious racists. People who are really, really horribly bad and stay that way, unrepentantly. Do you exclude hell? Do you say it doesn't exist? Is it out? And as far as reprobation is concerned, we'll be talking about this further into the hour. Calvin's emphasis on discipline, church discipline. Now we know this is very important, not only in Calvin, it was important for the refugees because the discipline held the community together, gave the community a definite sense of coherence. Calvin certainly emphasizes it. And I mentioned the discipline because it's always, when I've read through the Institutes and I see what he says about it, it almost looks to me like he mentions reprobation as a part of the discipline because it's supposed to scare you. It's supposed to scare people. If you're a lax Christian, right? How bad are you? It's intended to frighten. So come to that later when we get to the uses of the law further down. All right, persecutions in France and soon also in the Netherlands created thousands of refugees. Belief in election and in providence was a highly significant comfort. Now, this is documented in the texts, in the letters and so forth that we see. It's not something invented. It's there in the letters. It's documented. Calvin, pastor to pastors in France, once wrote, "We have no other place of refuge than God's providence," and that in the middle of persecution. Calvin frequently refers to 2 Timothy 2:19. I just might pause and say, this was Calvin's favorite book in the Bible. That little, what is it, three chapters of 2 Timothy, his favorite book in the Bible. Well, on the doctrine of election, God's firm foundation stands bearing his seal. The Lord knows who, those who are his. And then Calvin's comment, he will not forsake the work of his hands. Number three, Heiko Obermann, this great Reformation historian, if you ever have a chance to read him, I certainly recommend it. In his book, Two Reformations, quotes from a journal of a French school teacher who, after persecution, flight, long travail, the loss of his wife and four children, finds refuge in the Netherlands. He thanks God for the strength he has received from the assurance of election and providence. Obermann comments, and this is really striking what Obermann says about it. Within the horizon of the experience of persecution, this text is a precious experiential asset which churches subject to persecution can only dispense with to their great detriment, and which we, for as long as we may live under the protective canopy of democratic rights, must keep alive and pass on. Isn't that remarkable? What is being written by a historian who's read a great deal of this literature, seen all kinds of testimonies, and is making that kind of statement. And then the next, we're not just engaging in the historical analysis of an old debate, but dealing with the recognition of the structures of existence of refugees in our own time. Number four. At the beginning of the Reformation, before French and Dutch Calvinists became refugees escaping persecution, all theologians, Protestant and Catholic, regarded the forced dispersal of the Jews from Judea by the Romans as evidence of Jewish guilt. In Calvinism, 50 years later, this argument had completely disappeared. Instead of the Jews being an example of persecution, an example of guilt, the refugees identify now with what happened to the Jews. And you know the first place Jews are given full civil rights? The Netherlands. And not long after we get the establishment of the Dutch Republic. I think that's a remarkable fact, quite a turn. Then we go to the next, number five. Calvin and the development of Puritanism is where we're looking at his church discipline. He writes a good deal about church discipline. I've taken only one paragraph out of the Institutes, and I'm going to elaborate on it. But as this is from the Institutes, as the doctrine of Christ is the soul of the church, so does the discipline serve as its sinews through which the members of the body hold together. Discipline is like a bridle to restrain and tame those who rage against the doctrine of Christ, or like a spur to arouse those of little inclination, and sometimes like a father's rod to chastise mildly and with the gentleness of Christ's spirit those who have more seriously lapsed. Now, comment on the discipline. You read Calvin in the Institutes, and when he talks about things that really endanger one's church membership, and he will finally come to the point where you get excluded from church membership, which in those times was very bad. You were not admitted to the Lord's Supper, for example. And it doesn't mean that if you got excluded, you were doomed. He never said that. There was always the possibility right up to the very end that something would happen and a reversal would take place. But it's quite striking that when he talks about the bad sins, he really only means scandalous behavior. That's quite striking. Drunkenness, perpetual drunkenness, violence, terrible blasphemy, you know, things that wound the life of the church in a very serious way. He talks about weak Christians. He fully accepts weak Christians. Weak Christians are those who are weak in their faith, weak in their behavior, but he's not casting them out. They're not doomed. They're included. They're there. So it's very interesting, you know, those he, the way he talks about exclusion from the church, you really have to be bad to be excluded. Now, in Geneva, much like Zwingli's Zurich, everyone in the city pretty much belonged to the church unless you were excluded. But it's with Calvin that we get this difference between church and state. He separates them. He separates church and state. We have the first beginnings of presbytery. It's not yet presbytery. It's interesting. Presbytery is actually developed in among the refugees. In France, in the Netherlands, synods actually first developed there too. But we're getting the first rudiments of presbytery in Geneva as Calvin separates church and state. So pretty much everyone in the city this belongs. We know those were religious times anyway compared to what's today. So being excluded from the church was very big. There was sometimes very much disagreement about it when prominent people got caught in the exclusion for really bad behavior. But Calvin was known for holding firm, for being insistent on church discipline. Very interesting that church discipline was attractive to the refugee congregations. This is documented. It's something that they liked about Calvinism, as opposed, for example, to Lutheranism. They liked the discipline. The idea of the cohesion of the community held together by the discipline of the church. So it's a definitely, you could say it's a community idea. In the middle of persecution, minorities held together by their community discipline. That comes through as quite important in the history of the refugees. But if you look at civil government, Calvin gives civil government a great deal of authority. Striking how much authority over the church or for the church he gives the civil government. Okay, number six. Civil government has as its appointed end to cherish and protect the outward worship of God, to defend sound doctrine of piety and the position of the church, to adjust our life to society, to form our social behavior to civil righteousness, to reconcile us with one another, and to promote general peace and tranquility. Civil government. It's kind of an ideal, is it not, of what civil government might be. We go to the next, magistrates, number seven. civil government prevents idolatry. I would just pause there and say, this idolatry and sacrilege. He says, why would this, or we might ask, why would this be prevented? And he says, the first reason is, like bad behavior, it reflects back on Christ. And if this spreads, if this is encouraged and spread, it has a destructive effect on the whole community. So this is why he includes it in discipline. All right, civil government prevents idolatry, sacrilege against God's name, blasphemies against his truth, and other public offenses against religion from arising and spreading among the people. It prevents the public peace from being disturbed. It provides that each man may keep his property safe and sound. In short, it provides that a public manifestation of religion may exist among Christians and that humanity be maintained. And that's an interesting one at the end, isn't it? That humanity be maintained. Magistrates are ordained protectors and vindicators of public innocence, modesty, decency, and tranquility. And their sole endeavor should be to provide for the common safety and peace of all. And then if they remember that they are vicars of God, they should watch with all care, earnestness, and diligence to represent in themselves to men some image of divine providence, protection, goodness, benevolence, and justice. They are the deputies of God, to whom they must hereafter render account of the administration of their charge. So, I'll give you an example of something. It's not unusual in Geneva, but it's often pointed out as something very Calvinist. Prohibition of dancing. Now, Geneva wasn't the only place. These cities passed their moral laws, and dancing was often included. But Calvin in the Institute says nothing about dancing. That's city. Those are city laws. That's not in Calvin. When Calvin talks about scandalous behavior that's going to get you excluded from the church, certainly not dancing. It is those things we talked about before. He also, I didn't include it here, but he talks about the magistrates, their responsibility to overthrow lords or kings who are acting scandalously themselves. So there is this element that goes into Calvinist history of overthrowing or resistance against injustice higher up. He says no private citizen should ever assume to take this on themselves, but those in power below the higher ups, the rulers who are corrupt, should take responsibility and overthrow these people as needed. And he'll say things like, it's pretty bad to be under an oppressive prince or king, but it's much worse to be under one who's totally profligate, you know, who's totally corrupt. There's no sense of personal discipline, whatever. Any question up to this point or comment?
So I gather these were all new thoughts at
time. Excuse me?
I gather these were all new thoughts at that time.
What exactly are you referring to?
Everything you're telling us.
Yes. Well, the discipline, the concept of discipline. Yes, this is, where do we have discipline before? I don't know if you remember that when we talked about Luther. Erasmus had made the comment about the cities. They're the new monasteries because they're putting in such stringent laws. It wasn't just Geneva, it was happening in many cities, southern Germany and Switzerland. moral laws that were particularly stringent to protect the citizenry and to keep law and order in the city. So where we have this discipline prior is in the monasteries, right? The monastic life. And that's Erasmus's comment. The cities are the new monasteries because they're putting in all of these rules and regulations. It's typical, more typical of Reformation cities than Catholic cities, but it's there too. It's also in Catholic cities. So remember, in between Luther and Calvin, we have the Reformation of the cities, which we often leave out, right? It's one of the reasons why we don't know Zwingli that well. He's sandwiched in between two biggies, right? Luther and Calvin. Yes, Ted.
How do you reconcile Calvin's ideas about exclusion with the idea of the utter depravity of humans?
Total depravity, okay.
Right.
What does Calvin mean? Now you're picking up central ideas in Calvin that I've kind of excluded here, which is okay to pick them up and talk about them.
When you talk about exclusion for scandalous behavior or terrible sins, I kind of experience a disconnect related to the idea that humans suffer from total depravity. And so how do you rank those sins as more or less scandalous?
First of all, what does he mean by total depravity? Does he mean we're all dogs? Actually not. He means, by total depravity, he means every aspect of human life is touched by sin, everything, right? Now he does make some pretty strong statements about the state of sin, but total depravity doesn't, as it's often heard, the way you hear it, right? It sounds like people are awful, awful, awful. As a matter of fact, he talks about general grace, that we're going to be reading this text a little later here, that we're given reason. We're given all kinds of gifts that make life governable, manageable, but it doesn't erase the problem of sin or the effect of sin or the corruption of sin, right? So we certainly have these two. And if you just talk about total depravity and you don't know what it means, and you leave out the other side, general grace, you miss the point entirely. And this happens so very frequently when we talk about Calvin. Calvin gets reduced to some slogans, and that's it. You know, it's just a few slogans, and that's the end, end of any of anything in everything you know about Calvin. Yes, probably.
So just quickly, does grace cover
all human life?
Scandalous sins?
Calls all human life. Even, you might say even Hitler could reason, right? And he wasn't a blithering idiot. He was evil, but he used the gifts that were given for evil, right? But he had the gifts of general grace. One of them is reason, which I'm going to get to, Bobby.
So how do we determine what is scandalous behavior? In whose eyes is that?
Well, there again, he doesn't go into great detail. It would be helpful had he. He certainly talks about drunkenness. He talks about violence. He talks about behavior of people that is just never corrected. Now, I don't know that he ever understood what alcoholism was, right? There are certainly people who are alcoholic, I assume, back then. But that's a problem, that he does not go more into what scandalous behavior is. It is certainly behavior that destroys the community and that reflects in a very bad way back on Christ as who Christ is for the community. So again, it's a matter of discipline. Luther requires discipline too, just not like this. I don't know that Luther ever ever.
How are they different?
Well, I don't know that Luther ever wrote a full sermon or tract on discipline. He talks about it in between from time to time. He doesn't accept drunken behavior, right? He will exclude drunks from communion, right? But I don't know of any tracts or major writings or even minor writings of Luther where he focuses on discipline. I just don't remember it. But in between, frequently, it's Calvin who focuses, right? Who gives us church discipline in Protestantism for the first time. And then we see its great significance for the refugees, for the refugee movement. Charlotte?
John, I hope I'm not jumping ahead here, but as I look at these three theologians, it looks, and I hope I'm not just looking at space allocation, it's as if Zwingli was not that influential in terms of long-lasting influence, but that Calvin built on Luther and then extended it and continued it in a very significant way. Is that, yeah. Is that
yes,
fair?
Very true. But he also picked up Zwingli. There's a lot of Zwingli in him. His concept of justice by the magistrates. He separates church and state, certainly. Calvin does. But much of what he says about the responsibility of the state looks like what Zwingli's saying about the responsibility of the city council in Zurich, and then also in Bern. Bern becomes Zwinglian. At this time, this whole time, Bern is Zwinglian. Finney, I ran across this some time ago. Zwingli was for Switzerland what Luther was for the world. And that shows you the limitation, right? Zwingli's limitation. But the influence certainly goes into Calvin. Calvin reads Zwingli with appreciation. He disagrees with him on certain things, but he certainly appreciates Zwingli. One of the things that's definitely Zwinglian that comes down into our tradition. Now, I have known Pennsylvanians to affirm this, and we've mentioned it before. Communion 4 times a year. Calvin picks that up. That becomes a rule also in Geneva. He doesn't like it. He would prefer himself to have it actually every week. And then he talks about having it every month. But he accepts and adopts the Zwinglian tradition of 4 times a year, probably because it's pretty popular inside of Geneva because of the relationship to Bern. That's coming directly from Bern. Now, how many of you remember or have heard about communion 4 times a year? In the Presbyterian Church, right? Yeah, that comes directly from Zwingli. He says, when you do it, you've got to be serious. The more often you do it, the less serious. Very serious, right? And then I told you that joke about my experience in Switzerland, this guy saying, I don't go because I don't ever feel worthy. I don't feel worthy. But she went and she should not have gone. She wasn't worthy to go to the communion. It's supposed to be a sign of your personal commitment, your acceptance of Christ and reform of your personal life, right? And this, as far as I know, this guy hadn't been to communion since he got confirmed and he was in his 60s. There's very funny things that happen. You can't miss the humor in a lot. Was there another question or comment?
I have a question. This thing about election, I have a hard time understanding it. I can see where if I'm one of the elect, that's very comforting. For all my screw-ups, God's going to make sure that I go to heaven. But then I wonder, what about those who aren't elect? Can't God overcome their problems too? Or why would he create people who he knows are going to not be in heaven? Why would he do that if he's a loving God? Why would he create people that are really bad, you know, just irredeemably bad?
I have trouble
with that. And I don't know how Calvin resolves that himself. How could he think those things?
This has always been the point of major criticism of Calvin. And The only thing I can come back to is, again, for one thing, the significance in for the refugees is clearly there. The courage to persevere in the midst of terrible persecution. And the other side is, well, if there's election, there must be the other side. Now, Luther has election. Thomas Aquinas has election. Augustine has election. They're all there. Certainly it's in Paul. You've got, and in John. There's a place in Matthew that's there. On the other hand, reprobation, election is there, but not reprobation. Reprobation seems to be, well, if you're not elect, you must be on the other side. I can only, again, come back to this concept of discipline. If this is said, and this is the threat, get your tail into the church and get yourself reformed. Stop this stupid stuff you're living. And I mean, is Hitler in heaven by loving God? I doubt it, but I frankly don't know. Terrible racist who murder? Lynch justice? Does all this stuff pass over into heaven by loving God? I had a professor one time, he said, you know, he was talking about this, and he said, be careful. You eliminate hell, and you're eliminating too much, right? I'm not saying, you know, he's going to defend it. He says, be careful. Well, let me pass on. We can always come back, John, to the subject. Oh, the law of the Bible. Law of the Bible, according to Calvin, has three uses. It shows the righteousness of God, and as a mirror discloses our sinfulness, leading us to implore divine help, namely the grace of God in Christ. That's straight Luther, right? But it's also Paul. Calvin is his first teacher in Protestantism is clearly Luther. Again and again and again, you see the agreement with Luther. The second one, the law's dire threats restrain doers of evil. That's also a Luther. But then we come to the third use. And this is something Calvin's known for, the third use of the law. The third and principal use, which pertains more closely to the proper purpose of the law, finds its place among believers in whose hearts the Spirit of God already lives and reigns. Here is the best instrument for them to learn more thoroughly each day the nature of the Lord's will to which they aspire, and to confirm them in the understanding of it. By frequent meditation upon the servant of God, upon it, the servant of God will be aroused to obedience, be strengthened in it, and be drawn back from the slippery path of transgression. And there I can tell you, he refers especially to the Psalms. For example, Psalm 119 is one he quotes there. Now, Luther, this is not absent in Luther at all. He just doesn't call it the third use of the law. To read the Psalms with great appreciation when they're talking about the beautiful law of God. But this is, it's known in Calvin. This is very definitely part of Presbyterian theological tradition, the third use of the law. Now, when it comes, often it's confused with Puritanism. And that's why I put the Puritans here. There's a straight line here. We can trace it from Calvinism through the refugees into Netherlands, into England, and finally into New England. And I think it's very fascinating to look at this. Calvin's third use of the law by the Puritans is integrated back into the first. The law convicts of sin and also requires obedience, so that the grace of forgiveness occurs within the inclusive requirement of obedience. Puritans call themselves visible saints. They are visible. You have to be visible. They obey the law. For Calvin, as for Luther and Zwingli, forgiveness is not conditioned by the added requirement to fulfill the law. Faith receives God's love unconditionally, which expresses itself as love of God and neighbor in the life of the believer. There's the difference. Now you see it, you go to the next part. Separate my pages. Civil government, whose members are elected only by church members, supervises behavior more strictly than Calvin had required. For example, kissing in public is forbidden. Clothing may not be ostentatious or show signs of wealth. Now, this kissing in public, it's not like what we see today, you know, with public seems to be everywhere. Called television public, then you've certainly got a lot of it. But there's the example that's quoted often is the sea captain returns from a long sea voyage, and he meets his wife at the door and he kisses her. He spends 2 days in stocks. They put him in stocks for 2 days for kissing his wife at the door. They are very strict. And this has to do with this, the visible saints. If you are a true Christian, you keep the law. They are strict in that regard. Now, there's some beautiful things in Puritanism. What's the woman poet, Anne Bradstreet, who wrote poetry as a Puritan, and it's very beautiful poetry. No question about that. So we often do give the Puritans a bad reputation, which they deserve. But the strictness goes over into the American tradition, into American Protestantism. Very strict moralism. It comes out in different ways. One of them was the temperance movement. Certainly one of the things American Protestantism is known for is very heavy moralism very quick condemnation of those who don't quite match up. And I think it's always very important to remember the difference between the Puritans and Calvin and Luther and Zwingli too on this point. Now, I return to the concept of the predestination, and just to say that Calvin and Luther, and as far as I know, Zwingli, would never say that this election is experiences any kind of force. It's totally free will. And Calvin says that, Luther says it's free will, absolutely free will. But it's that text, especially in Philippians 2, God works the will in us. There is a mysterious working of the Spirit of God and the Word of God, which leads us to make free will decisions. But it's absolutely free will, just as reprobation, bad behavior, refusal, all of those things are free will. Now, how this applies to today, theologians have certainly modified much of this. For example, John, universal love of Christ, right? The universal love of God, the universal presence of Christ resurrected, the presence of God to everyone in the world. And a story I often tell, the young girl in India, let's say she's 10 years old, she's never heard anything about Christ. Probably the Indian government, especially today, preventing it from being heard. And she walks out into a day of beauty, blue skies and the love of her parents? And are we going to say, because she doesn't know Christ and probably never will in her life, that she is doomed? I think it is ridiculous to say that. The universal presence. On the other hand, before and still, it's still happening, but before Christians, it was far more common. The babies who weren't wanted were set out to die, especially females, set out to die. Another one was wives burning themselves on the pyres of their husbands when their husbands died. That stopped with Christianity. So we get into the whole area of mission and what Christianity has meant and continues to mean in mission. There we open a completely different subject. Now I got into, we have finally the comparison, but we've kind of come to the end. Perhaps I should just leave that for you to read, or do we want to continue? Ted, what would you suggest?
It's totally your expression.
Okay. Maybe okay. Let me pick out one item, one thing, reason. Now, if you read down there, the last section on Calvin, what he thinks about reason. Now, if you remember Zwingli, Zwingli gives a very high regard to reason. Reason is practically the door through which revelation comes for Zwingli. Calvin has a very high regard for heathen philosophers. If you look in the index to the institutes, you see quotations, constant quotations or citations to Plato, to Cicero, to Seneca. Why? Why so much attention to the heathen philosophers? Two reasons have been given. One is because of his own humanist background. He knows that this is the primary challenge to Christianity among the educated. The humanists are educated in the Greek philosophers. But the other reason is he will quote them constantly in support. For example, he says, piety, the government supporting piety is something said by all the great philosophers. And he'll quote them, he quotes them. And that they become authorities in that regard. Now, he doesn't say they give us revelation, they don't. He just cites the philosophers as examples of why government should support piety. And then there are others, other areas. What is the best kind of government? When he talks about the best kind of government, he goes back through the philosophers, what the philosophers said. Very interesting the way he does it. But they have nothing to do with revelation, nothing at all. But he spends a great deal of time with the philosophers. Thank you for your attention. I hope you gained some benefit from it.
Thank you so very much.